Hey, everybody, Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man here. And if you want to get your money's worth, then stay right here because you're listening to the Brad Gilmore Show. You know what? Remember one very important thing. Everybody's got a price for the Million Dollar Man.
Yeah. Oh, Brad, what have you done now?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the one and the only The Brad Gilmore Show on demand. It's been a minute, guys, and I'm excited to be back. Been working on a lot of projects. By the time this podcast drops, I might have made a big announcement about something that's been in the works for the last month or so and kind of came to me at a whim. So if that announcement is made, which I think it should be, I will refer to it next time on the show. But just know I've been working on a lot of good things. I'm in high gear in a lot of different projects. And today on the show, though, let's get to the point. Let's stop with all the BS. Y'all aren't here to hear me promote myself. I already called the damn show the Brad Gilmore Show. What more do you want? I'm here today. I got a special guest who's going to be joining me in a moment. Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man. Yes, one of the greatest wrestling heels of all time will be joining me on the show to talk about his new documentary, The Price of Fame. Now, this movie was released in theaters for like one day as a Fathom event, like on the 7th of November. And I got to watch the movie. They were gracious enough to send me a screener, and it's fantastic. And I'm not just saying that because he's on the show or what have you. This movie is great. It's kind of remnant of the resurrection of Jake the Snake. If you saw DDP's documentary on Jake Roberts, it has some similarities, but it's an awesome story. You know, I'm sure I'll talk to Ted about it, but he became a minister almost 20 years ago. And it's kind of an interesting switch from being a wrestling villain where everyone's got a price for you and you can buy anything you want to being at the behest of the Lord and preaching his word. Really interesting story by Ted DiBiase. And he really explains to the viewers, you know, what the price of fame really is. And, you know, be careful what you ask for. But it's an uplifting film. Couldn't recommend it enough. It should be out soon, I think, on video on demand. And I'll update you on the podcast and on my social media at Brad Gilmore when that happens. But guys, he'll be joining us here in a moment. But I want to take the time before he does tell y'all a little bit about my weekend in wrestling. You know, it was a fun week. The WWE was in town here in Houston, and you know what? You know, I might know a couple people over there, maybe one or two. And I got to go to NXT TakeOver, got to sit front row on the floor. You might have seen me, brother. I went with my buddy Kyle Hubbard, who was just on the show a couple weeks ago. We took in NXT TakeOver. It's my first NXT live event. It was really nice, really good show. There's actually a great screenshot floating around of myself, Kyle Hubbard, and Kevin Owens. And the photo completely looks posed. Like it looks like it wasn't a real photograph. It looks like everything's been photoshopped in because we're all looking different directions, and none of us are looking at the camera. And this is on WWE TV, not like on my iPhone. This is on a television show. None of us are looking at the camera. I didn't even know the camera was there, and it looks like we're like trying to take promo images for our new R&B rap group. And if me, Kyle Hubbard, and Kevin Owens were to form that group, I would call it Beastie Boys to Men. That's just, you know, off the top of the dome, brother. But NXT TakeOver was awesome. I just want to say that the Velveteen Dream, Patrick Clark was his name on Tough Enough. Booker and I interviewed him on Heated Conversations back when he was on the show, I do believe. And he was great. He was always my favorite on that show. And I thought that he and Aleister Black had a match of the year. I don't think it's the match of the year, but it's definitely a match of the year. I mean, I think Cena and Styles from the Rumble still have that spot, but this is like number two for me, at least. And it might have been different because I was there live watching it. But the story those guys told, I don't follow NXT week to week. And the story those guys told, they conveyed the entire angle to me within that match. And by the end of the match, I understood. I understood what they were trying to do. Velveteen Dream, I hope that he has a gimmick that translates to the main roster. I don't know if he does. I don't know if he'll end up in that Tyler Breeze kind of thing because he's kind of got the gold dusty kind of gimmick going on. But he's a star. At least in NXT, I say in the next 6-8 months, he's probably going to be the NXT champion. And I don't think that's a far stretch of the imagination. And Aleister Black's dope too. He's got a great entrance. I wish he didn't talk. I don't know where he's from. Is he from Ireland or something? Or Scotland? He has an accent. I don't know where he's from. I kind of like him as like the silent killer, you know? His name even sounds like I should never talk. But, you know, it was what it was. He sounds like he sounds. But the match was phenomenal. I also got to give a big shout out to Ember Moon. Ember Moon, who wrestled here in Houston with Reality Wrestling as Athena, trained at the school under Booker T. She won the NXT Women's Championship this past weekend at NXT TakeOver. She's always been great. Always knew that she'd be high up on the roster and be a big, big force in that women's division in NXT and eventually WWE. So big shout out to her. Andrade Cien Almas captures the NXT Championship. Didn't see that one coming. Drew McIntyre, who was also on our show last week on Heated Conversations. Get that podcast on iTunes. Was that I spazzed out? I think I did a little bit. He was great too. That match was phenomenal. And I didn't see him winning that title off of McIntyre, I should say. But hey, man, you got to make a new star. Andrade Cien Almas was kind of going on the decline there for a while. And then Zelina Vega, who better known as Thea Trinidad, they paired them together. And they've been rocking it, man. She's a great, great addition to that Andrade package. I mean, she's just as important to him as, you know, Lana was to Rusev. I won't go as far as say as Elizabeth was to Macho, but you see what I'm saying. Like, sometimes it's just that other little piece that's needed to really accentuate the main guy, the star, the superstar. And she's got a great look. She's got great character. She when she gets physically involved in the matches, she does them at the right times. It does the right moves, those hurricanranas. I liked that pairing a lot. And then the main event, the War Games match. Oh, man. And I don't want to call anybody out. But I'll just say I had a conversation with somebody beforehand. We all went to dinner, a few of us. Shout out to a guy named Mega Ran, by the way. I just met Mega Ran this weekend. Awesome dude. He's a rapper, wrestling fan, video game guy. Awesome guy. But we were all at the dinner and somebody was there who I love, but he was complaining that the top wasn't on the cage. And he was like, I mean, does anybody else freak out about this? I mean, there's no top on the cage. I would love to talk to him and ask him his reaction to that match because they did not need a top on the War Games cage. That was awesome. That match, the Undisputed Era, Roderick Strong and the Authors of Pain and Sanity went out there and rocked it. My man, I think his name's Wolf from Sanity. Forgive me, I'm not super familiar with NXT, but I think his name's Wolf. He had a hell of an awful gash that opened up on the side of his head after a big table spot where he went through two tables. And I saw the doctors running over to him and they've put in towels through the cage. I'm like, oh yeah, this is the worst match to possibly get some sort of injury like that where you're inside of a locked structure. So it's hard to, you know, medically attend to you. But they put some towels on him. They put the Vaseline on the gash. He finished the match. Props to the guy. I mean, he was cut up pretty bad, but, you know, he can hold his head high knowing that he had a hell of a match. And, for anyone who had any worries about War Games and it being three teams and this, and that, all those worries should be extinguished because they brought it. They brought it at that War Games match. So I enjoyed the show, had the best seat in the house, and couldn't have imagined going to a better NXT show than that this year. So props to Triple H and the NXT roster for putting on a hell of a War Games. And then I was back up at the Toyota Center the next night. for Survivor Series. I had to watch from back in the back a little bit, and I got to walk out into the arena. But another, I thought the standout matches on the show were the Shield versus New Day. Thought it was a great opener. I thought the Usos and the Bar had a hell of a match. I love that spot. I think it was Jey Uso did a dive and out to Cesaro. And as he's doing an outside dive, he tags Jimmy in. And Jimmy finishes the match with a big splash, I believe, on Sheamus. And they pick up the victory. Really great match. But I think the match of the night, to nobody's surprise, and no one should be surprised, was AJ Styles and Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar went after AJ. He started kicking his, you know what, his A double crooked letter. And then AJ came back, started firing an awesome assault, hit him with three or four forearms, boom, boom, bang. And then Brock picks him up, lays him out, F5, 1-2-3. But a lot more back and forth than most people thought. One of the best Brock matches. I think that was the best Brock Lesnar match since Royal Rumble 2015. It was solid. I mean, it was a solid match. So shout out to Brock Lesnar and AJ Styles, which, by the way, can I tell a backstage story real quick? I'm sitting there talking to the beautiful Queen Charmel, and we're talking. All of a sudden, I see her eyes get a little bit big, and then she she starts to smile, and I feel this massive presence come from beside me, and it's Brock Lesnar, and he picks up Charmel, gives her this big hug. It was so excited to see her. I just thought it was a funny sight to see. I mean, the first of many backstage. It was great to see The Undertaker and finally meet him in person. We've talked over email a few times. Got to meet him, though. Awesome guy. You know, Booker's kids call him Uncle Mark, which I thought was cool. And we all had a great time. It was good to see a lot of the guys there. Peter Rosenberg, good to catch up with him. Good to meet Sam Roberts. Mark Henry, good to see Mark Henry. Jinder Mahal. Jinder Mahal, I kind of got a beef with Jinder. I'll tell you why. And I like Jinder. Jinder came down to Reality Wrestling. Always loved Jinder. But here's my beef. I'm walking backstage, going back to catering, and Jinder Mahal and I stop and we chat for a minute, catch up. And then he tells me that I look like Mike Rome. Mike Rome, I guess, is the NXT ring announcer. Sometimes he does some backstage interviews on Raw and SmackDown. I've gotten this comparison before. I don't look like that guy, all right? I don't look like that guy. And all respect to Mike Rome. All respect to Mike Rome. I don't look like you, man. You don't look like me. We're our own people. We have a similar hairstyle, I'll give you that. Similar, it's not the same. To the untrained eye, it could look similar. But, you know, if you know what you're talking about, there's nothing. So, Jinder, we got beef, man. We got real beef. But I do want to talk about the main event. And I wasn't a big fan of the 5-on-5 main event, I'll be honest. The finish had me scratching my head. But I will tell you the best part. Those entrances, man, were so cool to take in live. Shinsuke, Finn, Bobby Roode, Triple H, John Cena, Shane McMahon, Kurt Angle, Braun Strowman, Randy Orton. I mean, those were really cool entrances to take in person. Especially Bobby Roode's was great. Triple H, though, out of that group has the best entrance. I mean, they have their, you know, and people are going to say, oh, well, of course, they put the most time behind him. But that guy has the best entrance at anybody in that match. And, you know, there's no pyro. All it is lights and spit and water. But that guy knows how to make an entrance. So that was my thoughts on Survivor Series. I think Survivor Series was a good show. I give it a B+. But I will give that filet mignon and catering an A+. But without further ado, I'm going to throw it over to my incredible interview with Ted DiBiase. I'm going to get him on the line right now. And we're going to talk to Ted about his new film, The Price of Fame. I got a lot of questions I want to ask him about in and outside the ring stuff. So stay tuned. Let's get Ted DiBiase on the line right now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. On the line with me, a very special guest. It's awesome to get to talk to him. He's got a new movie out right now called The Price of Fame, The Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. Ted, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, brother. How are you?
Hey, I can't complain. Can't complain. Thanks for coming on the show. So many things to get to you about here today. I mean, the Price of Fame. I got to watch the movie just a few hours ago. What a phenomenal film. You know, just it takes you through a lot of emotions. That whole movie does. How did the project come about originally, and then who approached you to it, and were you receptive to the idea?
I was receptive. It's a story within a story. Pete Fierro, who directed the thing and did all the editing. I met Pete, maybe 7 years ago, and he approached me. Actually, he was doing a favor for a friend, and which was to do what they would call a shoot interview, meaning we're going to talk real life and not wrestling storylines. And so anytime you start talking to me about my real life, I'm going to start telling you what Jesus is doing in it. I'm a minister now, have been for 17 years. So in Pete's own words at the time, he was the somewhat backslidden son of a minister. And he says, your story kind of snuck up on me. It's like God sneaking up on me and punching me between the eyes. And the story resonated with Pete and turned Pete's life around. And Pete's normal job, he does wedding photography and video. So he documents weddings. And so anytime I was in the area, in the New York area, he would come out and hear me speak, and we developed a relationship. And he just approached me one day and he said, Ted, he says, I know you've written a book and you've been on a lot of programs and you've told your story all over the world. And he said, but I'd like to tell it on film. And I said, wow. So I agreed to that, and it was more of a friendly thing. I said, I've got a book, I've got this, I've got that, and now we can have it on video. But I never envisioned, I never thought in my wildest dream, a Fathom event, 650 theaters across the United States. My son came along, and Ted Jr., who actually, when we went out to Arizona to do some filming, came along and he told me, he said, Dad, he says, I wasn't sure about Pete. He says, the reason I came along was I didn't know whether I was going to like him or want to beat him up. He was like protective of his dad. He says, I was making sure that somebody wasn't trying to take advantage of you. It was just kind of comical. And, but in the end, we've all ended up just a tremendous relationship. And, Ted Jr. had been in a movie and he had helped, people with other movies, so he was familiar with movie projects. And it took a long time to complete. There were a lot of setbacks along the way, and we get it completed actually a year ago. He said, Dad, I've just sent the documentary to the same guys who helped market a lot of faith-based movies that you're familiar with. God's Not Dead, God's Not Dead 2, Fireproof, Blindside. He said, they said they would take a look at it and get back to us after Christmas. Well, they called him back the next day and they said, wow. They said, this is good. This is raw. This is good stuff, and we want to help you get it out there. And so off we went, And so that Fathom event was November the 7th. And again, it's 650 theaters across the United States. Thousands of people saw it. And now we're gearing up for the digital distribution and DVD sales. We've had a lot of tremendous feedback. We have had no negative feedback. It's just incredible.
The film was fantastic. I don't think you could, there could be no critiques of that movie, just based on the story that it told. And, I think a lot of the fans, I work here in Houston with Booker T for his wrestling show and do the radio show with him. And, you see these guys on television, you don't realize the real life stories that they have. And, you know, you're one of those guys who have a great story. Like Booker's story was from prison to promise, and now he's, you know, got his own company, you know, on Raw every week as one of the broadcasters. And you've had just an incredible story. You said you became a minister 17 years ago?
Yeah. In 2000 was when I, you know, when I stepped out full time. You know, in 1992 is when all the poop hit the fan, so to speak, with my wife discovering what I was doing, and that began the process of and the restoration of our relationship and just a total turnaround in my life. But I never, you know, I never envisioned that it would be a minister. It was just one of it's hard to explain. It's a, you know, 2 years later, on invitation, I started going to churches and sharing the story. And it became like a snowball rolling downhill. The more I went, the more invitations I got. And as I began to see, especially at that time, the demographic of a wrestling fan was you know, in the late 80s and the early 90s, it was teenagers, young kids. And those were the groups that I was speaking to. And, when you realize that your story and I say God working through me, reaching people's lives and changing them. I mean, I've wrestled in front of 80,000 people at Wembley Stadium. That's a pretty big thrill. But I'm going to tell you what, bro, it doesn't come close. It doesn't even come close to seeing a young man or a young lady broken before God and willing to change their life for the better. And, you know, the more I did that, the more I saw it, the more that grew on me. And it was just a natural thing for me to do. And as my relationship with God grew and, my understanding of scripture and a lot of things, it was kind of like when I connected all the dots, I knew that's what I was supposed to be doing. And that's what I've been doing. And this documentary, I mean, even if you're not a person of faith, as I am, I would hope that people could walk away from this whenever they see it and understand, and this sounds crazy coming from the guy who called himself the $1 million man. The irony is incredible, because the $1 million man is everything that God wouldn't want you to be. And that he stands for everything that's not fulfilling in life, because all of those things that we chase, money, fame, big houses and cars and prestige and all that stuff, they'll pacify you for a little while, but they're never going to give you peace, and they're never going to fulfill you. I mean, you know, just go look at all the people that hit the lotto. 98% of everybody who's ever hit the lotto, statistically, they end up worse than they were before. Money's not happiness. And, you know, people ask me all the time, they go, Ted, are you really the $1 million man? I go, nope, I'm not. I said, you know, I don't have an unlimited bank account. I said, but anyway, I tell you what I do have. I said, today I have the love and respect of my wife, as well as the love and respect of my children, my boys, and the unbelievable opportunity and pleasure to watch my grandchildren grow up. And I said, you can't put a price on things like that. And I said, I have a peace in my life that I didn't have for a very long time, because, you know, for so many years, it was all about Ted. It was me chasing that, you know, and it's okay to be ambitious. It's okay to want to be the best you can be. I encourage you to do that. You know, chase your dream. You know what? You know, so if you're willing to work hard, if you're willing to pay the price, you can be anything you want to be. But, you know, I always put it this way. Do it so that you can help somebody else. Do it for the glory of God, not for the glory of self. And that's what I'm trying to do with my life now, is pay it forward. You know, I've been blessed. I've had a lot. I've enjoyed a lot of fame. And it's amazing that I'm 63 years old. And I still travel and I speak, you know, and it's amazing that I walk through airports and it's like, I feel like more people know me now than knew me 20 years ago.
Well, you know, you have one of the most recognizable personas of all time, the $1 million man.
I don't walk around with dollar signs on my clothes.
Not anymore anyway, right? You know, I wanted to ask you about the $1 million man. I mean, such a great character in pro wrestling. I remember we had a television taping. I was talking to Bruce Prichard, who I'm sure you're familiar with, and we were talking, and he told me a story about, and I'm sure you've heard this, he was on a plane and he was on a plane with Vince McMahon and Vince, you know, I know you know where I'm going with it, but you know, Vince kept telling this guy to put his cigarette out, and he kept upping the price. And Bruce then figured out, oh, the Million Dollar Man is kind of like a, you know, Vince McMahon blown to a million bajillion, right?
Right.
When did you make that realization? You know, I don't know if you're a fan of Seinfeld, but the George Costanza character was based on the creator Larry David, and he had this like light bulb moment one day where he figured it out. Did you know off the top, like it was kind of a Vince McMahon to, you know, blown up?
Well, I knew because in our first meeting. And this is an incredible story because, you know, Vince, you know, I had worked up there before when, you know, like in 1979, I was there for about a year. Matter of fact, my last match in the old WWF was in Madison Square Garden against some new young guy named Hulk Hogan. I had Hogan's first match in Madison Square Garden.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's awesome.
He was the heel. And I was the baby face. And, but anyway, I had been up there before. And so, I was familiar with the McMahons and everything. And, Vince said, Teddy, said, I've got this great idea. I said, he says, I think you're the guy for it. He said, but I can't tell you what it is unless you agree to sign with us because I don't want to take the chance of giving away a really good idea. And it's something that's never been done before. And everything in our business has been done and redone. And, so I had to kind of go on faith. Well, he got a phone call and he got called out of the office for a moment, but I was sitting there with him and Pat Patterson. Now, Pat was his right-hand man, you know, well, I would say, you know, Pat, Bruce Pritchard, and he did most of the booking. And Bruce and I were very, very good friends. It was Bruce who told me that, Vince was interested in me. But, you know, Pat looked at me and he said, Ted, here's all you need to know. He says, if Vince could be a character in his own show, this is who he would be. It's almost like you're going to be the alter ego. You're going to be the character that Vince would be if he could be a character in his own show. And, you know, and that was enough. I said, okay, you know, and so I had to trust that, whatever this character was that, you know, I would obviously fit the role. And I did because as a heel, I always carried myself that way, aloof. I always talked down to the crowd and the people. And, you know, I was always what we call, you know, excuse the term, but chicken shit heel. Mm-hmm. the guy who talks real big, you bully. He talks real big, but then when somebody confronts him, you know, all of a sudden he becomes a coward and he runs. And, you know, you never get tired of seeing that guy get his butt kicked.
So, you'll always pay money. Everyone will pay a price to pay.
Yeah, they just never, you know, no matter how many times somebody kicks your rear end, they'll pay to see it again. And that's the type of a heel this guy was. So, and Bruce, you know, after the fact, obviously, Bruce told me that story about him and Vince on the airplane. And he basically was demonstrating to Bruce the truth and what, and the saying, everybody's got a price.
Yeah. I thought it was always a great story. I loved hearing that. But you know, I think the Million Dollar Man also came in with probably, and see if you agree with me, probably the greatest vignettes. It was either you or Mr. Perfect who had the greatest wrestling vignettes of all time. I mean, everything that you did was so perfect to that character.
Well, we had a lot of fun doing it. And yeah, you know, the vignettes were a lot of fun and Bruce was right there. He, you know, he helped produce, all of those first vignettes that I did. Now the one that wasn't a vignette, but it was done on television during a show that I hear about more than anything I ever did was when I offered the little kid $500 to dribble a basketball, and then I kicked the ball. And people ask me, they go, did you really do that to that kid? And I go, of course not. I mean, it was staged. It was, you know, and it was rehearsed. But when we did it live, he's a little kid, and you know, I had to be hardcore with him, which I didn't do during the rehearsal. And it scared him. It made him cry. he ran to his mother, and I mean, you know, I got in the back and everybody was doing high fives and I was going, I'm glad you're all happy, but now can you find an armored vehicle to get me out of the building? They want to kill me. So anyway, it was a lot of fun.
Now you say this is one more thing I want to ask. So you say in this business everything's been done and redone again, and that's a true statement. But you did something though also in your career that has never been done, and I just want your idea, your take on the idea when it was pitched to you, when the idea was pitched that the Million Dollar Man would not win the championship, but he'd buy the championship. It was just such a phenomenal decision to do. When they came to you with that idea, were you like, oh, yes, this is awesome?
Well, you know, and again, wrestling is show business. It always has been. And it's sports drama. And, you know, I've always said, and people ask me if, you know, it wasn't I disappointed that I was never the world champion. And I've always said that, you know, well, you know, not really, because it's work. It's not, you're not really the world champion. You know, you're playing a role. And so it's kind of like championship belts or props, but you know, there's been a little, I can't remember exactly who, but you know, some of the commentators that, you know, they didn't really agree with me. And I was at least watching reading what they had written. And I understand now. If you go back to like the NWA and the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, or the you know, I think Vern Gagne had a champion up there in his territory too. But there was a time when the champion, for example, in the NWA, the NWA World Champion would go to the territories that were underneath that agreement. So, you know, Florida, Georgia, and just, you know,
Houston.
Mid-South pulled out. Bill Watts pulled out because he said, I don't need it. But if you're the champion for the NWA, you're going to be going to all these different territories, and you're going to have the skill to wrestle with anybody they put you in the ring with. In other words, you know, you've got to be able to go in, because usually if you're the champion, you go in and you're, you know, unlike the WWF, the world champion, when he would come into a territory, you only saw him like maybe once or twice a year, or maybe three times a year. So they would always put the champion against their top babyface. And so what you have to have the ability to make that guy. Now that's where it makes a difference, because, you know, the guys that ended up being the world champion were all guys that were qualified to do that. In other words, people have said, you know, DiBiase, you could work with a broom. Well, you know, and that's because I learned from guys like Harley Race and Dick Murdoch and the Funks and a lot of those guys who had been world champions, where that's old school wrestling. When you got in the ring, the heel is the leader. He's the one calling the shots. You know, nothing was scripted. The only thing that was scripted, so to speak, or you knew for certain, was exactly how it would end. And in a lot of cases, because you can't beat the champion if you're just coming through. That's why oftentimes the world champion would end up going a 1 hour draw with whoever they wrestled. So, I mean, he's wrestling, you know, you got to be in really good shape too. So where those things factor in, it's meaningful. But in the WWF, you know, Hulk Hogan was the champion, and, you know, he's this hero, and Vince McMahon had made cartoon characters basically out of the wrestlers. It was like he made us family entertainment, the over the top, the Million Dollar Man. Come on, I might as well have been Snidely Whiplash, you know, with the boisterous laugh, and so you knew who the good guys were, you knew who the bad guys were, and you knew that your hero was going to ultimately win. So when Pat Patterson actually approached me, because originally the thought was that I would win WrestleMania 4. And when he approached me and he said, Ted, he said, you know what? That's what everybody expects. You know, that somehow you're going to, again, do what we've told them. You're going to find a way to buy the title, or, you know, or through your paying somebody off. Somebody helps you cheat to win. And you, then you have your run with Hogan. He says, that's what people expect. Well, what if we don't do that? What if you don't win the tournament and in your arrogance, you create your own championship? And as soon as he said it, I went, that is genius. Because the whole idea in this business is you make your hot heel the hottest you can make him. And that's what they did. People were like, you arrogant, no good, so-and-so, right? And it was, it was a stroke of genius. And I made more money being the million-dollar man and the million-dollar champion and toting my own belt. I wrestled with Hogan. I had title matches with him, and then I had other matches with him. And I had tag team matches with him, all over the WWF, which was all over the country. So in that regard, it wasn't that, it was like, would I have loved to have been the world champion? Sure. But did it do anything to harm my career in any way? No, that I didn't get it. No, it didn't. Now I stayed, at the NWA continued, and I was in line to be champion in the NWA. At one point there was the three names in the hat were Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, and me. And of course, Dusty and Rick both had the belt from, at different times. And then, I'd gone back to work for Bill Watts down in Mid-South. And Bill Watts, since that's where the territory I was working was not, he wasn't part of the deal. And so I guess, they kind of forgot about me. But, by and large, it's like, would I have loved to have been champion at some point? Sure. Why not? But did it hurt my career? No, not at all.
No, absolutely not. And like you said, you're walking down the airport, people still, screaming million dollar man at you, Ted DiBiase. One more question, Ted, before we get you out of here, and I appreciate you for doing this. The name of the documentary is Price of Fame. And I just want to ask you, after going through this incredible career for the last 17 years, you've been, preaching the word. You've been a minister, and now you have this documentary that tells that story. For you, what, in your definition, is the price of fame?
Well, the price of fame is ultimately whatever you make it. And I guess, again, I wanted people to see this story and realize that there were several things I wanted people to see. Number one, to realize that I came out of a very small town, and out of a severe experience, my dad dies, my mother starts drinking, and I'm in this little town with three traffic lights. And what I did not do at that time was succumb to what most kids do. Not too much to do in a little town like that on the weekends except party. And that's what the cool crowd did. But I didn't do that because I had a father in my life who not only was a professional wrestler, but an amateur wrestler, three-time conference champion at the University of Nebraska, lettered at Nebraska 8 times, 4 years in football, 4 in wrestling, storied career, and still very well known as one of the greatest athletes to ever come through Nebraska. And here's a kid who came out of basically the Italian hood, a very ethnic neighborhood, South Omaha, Nebraska. Both of his parents, Italian immigrants, and he made something of himself, and he would tell me, son, don't follow the crowd. Don't do what everybody else is doing just because they're doing it. That's easy. That doesn't take any courage. He said, what takes courage is to cut your own path in life. Be a leader, not a follower. Be the head, not the tail. He said, if you work hard enough, if you want something bad enough and you work hard enough for it, you can be anything you want to be. And I took that to heart, and it came true for me. But when I got there, when I got the college scholarship to go play football, and then I got out of college and I went into wrestling, and my career begins to rocket, and then I got all caught up in it, and I got all full of myself, so to speak. And that's where, people see you in an arena and they see thousands of people screaming your name, and everybody recognizes you and knows you. And I think, oh boy, how cool that is. Well, yeah, It can be. But what they don't see is they don't see you when that show is over and you go back to the hotel in that city that is not your home and you're not familiar with. And there's four walls and a TV set and your family's not there. And they're either, they could be 20 miles away or 2,000 miles away, but they're not there. And that becomes a very lonely place. And then you do that night after night after night for nearly 300 nights out of the year. So that becomes your life. And that's when you start sauntering down to the bar because you don't want to sit in that empty room alone. And you have a beer and one turns into two. And then the pretty girl comes up and sits down next to you. And down the road you go. And that's what happened to me. And so the price of fame can be high. But if people said, would you do it again? I said, I loved running. I loved wrestling. Yes, I would do that again. But knowing what I know now, there's a lot of things I would have changed in my life. I would have built a lot more accountability into my life. And the great news about the WWE today is they've built a lot of accountability into it now. I mean, the drug testing had just started when I was there. Now it's state of the art. Now they hire a company and it's like, my son told me when he was there, he said, Daddy, says, if I went to the doctor and I was prescribed an antibiotic, I have to then call the WWE doctor and tell them that I've been to the doctor and what I've been prescribed, because if I don't tell them and it shows up in a piss test, then I'm off for 30 days. That's how strict they are now. And so that's accountability in terms of the drugs and all the other, and the other stuff. So, you know, I would build those things into my life. But the other thing that's great about the company now is we were off 6 days a month. These guys are off at least 2 days a week, sometimes 3 days a week, depending on what shows you're on. So there's a lot of things that have changed for the better. But still, whether it's wrestling or football or whatever, when you're a celebrity, you don't have to look for trouble. It'll come find you. It will come literally knock on your door. And so you've got to build accountability into your life. And it's just the way you look at things, and when I realized when my wife had discovered that I had been unfaithful and I told her I didn't want to talk about it on the phone, that I'd be on the next plane home. She said, no, you won't. You don't live here anymore. You talk about, the cold slap to the face. In a fraction of a second, you realize you've put at risk the most valuable thing in your life. The love and devotion of a committed woman, a wife, not to mention the future and the stability of your children. And when I realized that, I thought, boy, what a selfish a-hole I had been. I wasn't thinking about anybody but myself. And so it's when that happened. That's what it took to turn me back around, to go back to that person that used to go to the cemetery where my father's buried, which is in the story, and cry out. And it's funny, Pete, when Pete and I went out to that cemetery, he said, Ted, I want you to take me out to the place where you used to go talk to your dad when you were, when you were feeling whatever you were feeling, when you were happy, when you were sad, just when you needed to get away. And so I thought he was going to go out there and just stand in front of it and interview me. Right. And so he said, Ted, here's what I want you to do. He said, now you probably haven't been here in a long time. I said, no, I haven't. And usually when I go out there, I go out there during the day, when I go back to that little town to visit. And so we're out there at night, which is what I used to do. I'd go out there and I would shine the lights of my grandmother's car on my father's grave. And I would walk back and forth in front of it, talk to God, talk to my dad. I mean, I knew it, I was looking for, it was my prayer closet, so to speak. And I had not been there in a long time. And a lot of these things had taken place. And so he said, I want you to come back. He said, I want you to approach this, and I want you to talk to your dad again. And talk to him like you've not been here since you left here from high school. Oh, my gosh. I had no idea what that was going to do. And it just, so what you saw was real. What you saw was very organic and very, very real and very heartfelt.
And it's an incredible story. I urge everybody to go watch the documentary, Ted DiBiase, The Price of Fame. You can find it. Just do a quick Google search. You'll find the documentary. It is incredible. That Fathom event, I'm sure, was an awesome experience. Ted, thank you so much for taking the time. This was really awesome.
Well, brother, I appreciate the time. And here's the thing, where you can find The Price of Fame, it's not in theaters. That was a one-day event, but it will start looking for it because there will be a digital release, and that may be iTunes. We're not sure just yet. A lot of those things are being negotiated, but we're hopeful that just before Christmas, it will be available digitally and on DVD. But it will be out there, so keep looking. And you know, you can go to MDM Ted DiBiase. I've got that's my Twitter. You know, and I've got a public $1,000,000man.com. I've got a website, and just keep checking those places, and it'll be out real soon.
And we will definitely share it also on our social media at Brad Gilmore and more. So Ted DiBiase, thank you once again. The Price of Fame out soon. It's a documentary worth seeking out. Like Ted said, even if you're not a faith-based person like Ted or I are, you will definitely enjoy this film just based on the story. And you don't even have to be a wrestling fan. You will just enjoy it on the incredible journey of one man's life. The Price of Fame, you can get it real, real soon. Ted, thanks once again.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you.
Oh, Brad, what have you done now?